Welcome to Meat Lake Production Interviews. This podcast is the audio version of video interviews that can be found in our YouTube channel or at meatlake.com. The video version will include many visual references that cannot be addressed in audio format. The podcast will now commence. Welcome to another Meat Lake Productions interview. I'm Eric Meat Lake, and today I have with me a young man named Bruce Horak. Bruce is a visual artist, a performance artist, a musician, an actor on stage, and a lifelong Trekkie that you know and love from multiple characters in Strange New Worlds and very short treks. Bruce, is very nice to meet you. And did I leave out anything in the intro?
That's great. Nicely done. Nicely done. And nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. It's great to meet you. So just to briefly touch on your education, you are Canadian and you went to the Mount Royal University. Is that correct?
Mount Royal College at the time. It's university now. But yeah, I took a two-year introduction to theater course at Mount Royal College in Calgary.
Mm-hmm. I see. And then I have listed under education, I might have this wrong, Loose Moose Theater and yes. The Mantlin Conservatory for Creation and Performance. Are those both learning facilities or are those where you worked and practiced?
Well, Loose Moose Theater in Calgary is a working theater. It's an improv company. It was started by Keith Johnstone in, I don't know what year, but in Calgary. And their primary thing was doing improvisational shows and kind of leaping off of some of his teaching. So the way the theater worked was if you show up at 6 o'clock and take a 1 hour class, mm-hmm. At the end of the class, the Keith or whoever was directing the show that night would say, who wants to play tonight? And the students put their hands up and he would choose who was going to perform in the show that night. You would get this education in exchange for volunteer hours. So ripping tickets, selling popcorn, that kind of thing. So it was very much an exchange program. You would get education, and then following every show you would also do notes with Keith, so you would actually perform in front of an audience, do the whole show, and then afterwards everyone would meet in the green room and you would do notes and the education would continue. So it was very much a learning, a performing institution. The Manitoulin Island for Creation and Conservatory for Creation and Development, or whatever they used to be called, was on a little island in Ontario at a farm, and it was a fellow named John Turner who led these classes. So I took one was a 14-day intro to clown. So we lived on the farm, camped on the farm, met in the barn at 9 o'clock in the morning and did workshop exercises, etc., until 5 o'clock at night, and then we would kind of be let loose on the farm for 2 weeks. And I also took a teacher training course there, so learned to run that particular clown workshop up at the Manitoulin Conservatory. I don't think it exists anymore, but John is definitely still teaching. Yeah.
I see. That's very nice. And then afterwards, I have listed that you're performing with Calgary's Shakespeare in the Park.
Yes, sir.
And you did that for 6 seasons. Mm-hmm. And Children's Theater Company, Quest Theater.
That's right. Yeah. Toured all over Alberta from the back of a van. There were like three actors and a stage manager. We would drive. We'd show up at an elementary school at 7:30 in the morning, set up our set, do a 1 hour show, do a Q&A with the kids, pack up the set, go for lunch, drive to the next school, do a show in the afternoon, and did that for 5 days a week. I must have toured maybe four shows with Quest. So, 3 months at a time, kind of driving all over Alberta, going to all the small towns. And it's quite a life.
that's nice. It's like an old style traveling circus almost for kids, especially. Kids must have loved that.
I hope so. I mean, when I was in grade three, Quest Theater, the company that I ended up working for, came to my school. And I saw them perform a show in our gymnasium, and I was really quite entranced by it. And the thought of, being part of a traveling troupe of actors was very appealing. And I honestly, I so, so enjoyed the work. Performing for children, especially, is a very humbling thing to do. They're very honest. If they don't like the show, they will tell you flat out. But also, if they're engaged with it, if they're intrigued by what's happening, they're also totally willing to buy into the magic of it. And yeah, there were some really wonderful, wonderful experiences during that time.
I see.
Formative, formative.
And listen, I also have listed Vancouver's Monster Theater. And is this something that you are still involved with, or?
Monster Theater started in Calgary, and it was actually Ryan Gladstone who was a fellow performer in Calgary, went to Loose Moose Theater, and he started touring Monster Theater, I think in the summer of 2000, as a fringe theater company. So they would do from Montreal all the way to Vancouver, Victoria, over the course of a summer. There's various 10-day festivals in every city, so you can go from one end of Canada to the other over the course of the summer and jump from city to city over the course of 10 days in each city doing your shows. And there's indoor venues, outdoor venues, and it's very much a traveling circus. Performers from all over the world come and do the North American fringe circuit. I think there's almost 40 now in North America alone. And Monster Theater started touring the fringe circuit. I joined Monster in 2001, and Ryan and I wrote a show called The Complete History of Canada in 1 hour. Three performers doing all of Canadian history. And we toured that for a couple of years. And then Monster started to really develop shows based on history. So reinterpretations, reimaginings of history to make it contemporary or current. The first show was the Canada show. The second show was the History of the World in an Hour. Our third show was a History of the Fringe Circuit. And, I created many, many shows with Monster. They eventually, this was Ryan's company, really relocated to Vancouver, and they continue to do shows. Currently, they're doing a show called Juliet, a revenge comedy, which Ryan wrote and or co-wrote, co-created with Pippa Mackey, one of the Vancouver actress. And it's a three-person show, primarily. Well, yeah, it's a three-person show, I should say. Shakespeare does make an appearance, and it's the premise is, what if Juliet decided to leave the page and join all the other women of Shakespeare's plays and hunt down Shakespeare himself, hold him accountable? Right, yeah, they're very much still creating shows. I am less associated with them now because I don't live in Vancouver or the West Coast. Yeah.
When you were performing, was in Canada, were all of your performances in English, or do you speak French as well?
I do not speak French, no. Their
Okay.
shows are entirely in English, yeah.
I see. So, and then I also have here that you are involved in Wingspan Collective, which is it. Are you still involved with Wingspan Collective?
I'm not involved with Wingspan anymore. This was a collective of artists with disabilities out in on the West Coast. I've relocated out east now. But yeah, Wingspan was as a collective of artists with disabilities who are just kind of getting their names out there and banding together in strength and solidarity to continue to push the practices of disability art in Canada.
I see. So I wanted to ask you about one of your works in particular, that you have listed on your website was Assassinating Thompson. And on one of the videos that you have, it's sort of a promo where you're on stage and you're doing a live action painting of the audience while you're in there. And I wanted to ask you what it was that brought you to the medium of painting to express yourself. And partly I ask because I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts myself, and when I'm working in two dimensions, I tend to gravitate towards pencil or pen and ink. And I like the control of it. And for me, painting just has always seemed very daunting just because of the chaos of having a liquid medium. It's like sand, it can get everywhere if you're not
Oh yeah.
careful.
Yeah, it's
What was it
messy.
that attracted you to paint?
I think exactly that. It's messy, it's sloppy. It surprises me. I love the texture of paint. I love the depth that it gives. It's almost a sculptural medium. And I'm just intrigued by that. I love working in acrylic for the layers. And I often I'll start a painting with really no conception of how it's going to turn out, and within three or four strokes of the brush, suddenly I'm seeing things within it. I mean, it's that Yeah, how our brains automatically start seeing things and interpreting things that maybe are not there, or are there in some way that, you turn the canvas over and suddenly you've got a new drawing. It's a communication that I really appreciate with acrylic paint. Out of all the mediums that I've traveled with, I mean, I really love charcoal too. Just for that sloppiness and the depth of it all. I found when I'm working in pen and ink or with pencil, I tend to I want it to be bigger and fatter than it is. That's why I like working in big brushes and large sizes if I possibly can, just for convenience of travel, because I am on the road so much. Oftentimes it's just not feasible to be hauling around all that acrylic paint. Assassinating Thompson was really just an excuse to haul my paints around.
Yeah.
Set them up, Yeah. Because, I mean, yeah, it's true. Like having a pencil and a piece of paper, I mean, you can kind of have that in your backpack at any time, but getting an easel and a canvas out and, all your paints organized and all that can be, it's a bit more time consuming, a bit more work. So I've got to create a whole show in order to set it up.
Setting up an easel and setting up, making sure that you're not, dropping your materials everywhere and stepping in it. That's a performance. That's a performance of itself. I remember my first college life was Kansas City Art Institute, and I would wander into the painter studios, and I just felt like I was in a person's nest, because they just had their own little, as like a standing cubicle where everything was just a sort of a tornado of chaos. And I respected that a lot, but I definitely did not gravitate towards it myself.
It is, yeah. It's pretty messy. There's a lot of gunk, but I kind of dig that. I feel very childlike when I get to play in the paint for a while. And working, I did a couple of residencies on Toronto Island, and would basically given like a full studio room that I can, and you could staple canvas to the wall and throw paint around and like really make a mess of the place. And yeah, it felt very, I won't say infantile, that's not the right word at all, but or juvenile for that matter. But I did, I felt like I was very free with it. And being able to put a 4 foot tall canvas, 4 foot wide canvas, staple it to the wall and just get physical with it felt like the combination of a couple of my loves, which is dance and painting, visual art, and being able to figure a way to combine these two mediums together. Made a lot of sense to me. It's not always practical, especially when you're sharing a space with two to three other human beings to be able to do that. But yeah, in my dream of dreams is to have that kind of a space where you can really just make a huge mess.
Yeah, I can definitely understand that. That's for sure. And I also wanted to ask about, what exactly is it about the challenges of portrait work that you enjoy the most?
Ooh, this is a good question. So I'll tell you, I started doing portraiture officially. I have a start date for it. It's April 1st, 2011, and I had been in Calgary for a couple of weeks and rented a beautiful studio to teach a class, to actually teach a clown workshop in Calgary. And I kind of hung up my shingle and announced that I was there to teach. And on the first day of class, I had one student show up, and it was someone I had gone to college with. Big shout out to Brandon Harris in Calgary. Hey, Brandon, thanks for showing up to that class. Because during he showed up, I had this whole, it was an old church, and so the upstairs had been converted into like a theater space, and downstairs of the church was full on workshop. And the church had been bought or leased by a puppet company called Green Fools. Shout out to Dean Barham, who rented me this beautiful space to work and do my clown stuff. And so I had an enormous amount of space and no students and no class to run. But Brandon showed up and we got talking. And Brandon and I went to theater school together, but we'd sort of gone our own ways and had our own lives. It had been 15 years or something since we'd been in school together. So we were having a really good catch up. And Brandon noticed that I had my white cane with me, which I did not use when I was at theater school. And he was asking, like, well, how's your eyesight and what's going on? And I kind of explained to him, someone who had known me for all these years, about how I had lost 91% of my eyesight when I was a baby. I had cancer as a child, and essentially I see about 9%, very limited field of view. And I was going on to describe all this, and Brandon's shaking his head. He's like, I had no idea that it was like that. And I said, well, let me try to express to you how it is that I see the world. And so we went and got some canvas and some paint from the basement because it was this beautiful studio. And I tried painting Brandon's portrait to capture how I see. And by serendipity, Brandon's wife is also a visual artist. And, he's tied into that world as well. And there was a call for submissions from the Harbourfront Centre in Toronto. They were looking for portraiture. They're doing an installation of likenesses and the exploration of portraiture. And Brandon said, oh, you should submit to this and for, submit an art, whatever. And basically all they were looking for was five or six photographs of portraiture that you've done and an artist statement, neither of which I had. So I decided to use my 2 weeks in the Green Fool space in Calgary, invite people to come and sit for portraits and try to figure out how I could interpret the way that I see on canvas through the medium of acrylic paint. And it just became this absolute passion. I would get up in the morning, I would take the bus to the church, I would open it up, I would have a sitting at 10 a.m. We'd, sit for an hour and a half, I would clean up, I'd go for lunch, I'd come back and do another sitting, and then have dinner, and then come back and do another sitting. And it just became this full-time job for 2 weeks of trying to get enough portraiture to submit for the Harbourfront Centre. And honestly, by the end of the 2 weeks, I was hooked. I was hooked not only on the practice of painting, and I would set up the 20 portraits together, and I could see the progression between each one because it was a daily practice. It was like it became my job, and I could really see the difference between number one and number 24. And I'm like, what would happen if I kept going? Could I keep going? And along the way, I sat primarily with friends and colleagues, so people involved in theater, visual art, music, whatever. And just the amount of encouragement I got from people to keep going, and I saw a huge progression in my work. And yeah, every portrait would teach me something, and every sitting would be this really wonderful connection. Now I sit with people all over the world. I've done 700 portraits now. I think I'm at 705. I now sit with people over Zoom, and it's a connection with people. It's, we spend half hour, 45 minutes meeting someone that you've never met before. Maybe they're in a whole other part of the world. And I get to mark the time with an expression of how I see, an expression of the connection, and a reminder of where I've been and what I've been doing and who I'm connecting with. I find it really invigorating and intriguing. I don't know if I will stop at 1,000, but I'm certainly intrigued to see what number 1,000 will look like. I do a self-portrait every 100, so I've done
Wow.
seven self-portraits,
That's nice.
and I find it, yeah, I just find the transformation and the changes in style and tech, even the technique. I mean, I can't say that I'm practicing well, but I'm certainly practicing.
That's probably the most important part, and especially if you're enjoying it. Like, can
I really
you,
am.
when you're looking at like the progression that you've made, do you find that you're more comfortable in experimenting with color, or was that ever an issue for you from the beginning, or have
Well,
you?
with color, I think this has been the same since the very beginning, but because of the damage that I have had done to my right eye is artificial, but my left eye, I had radiation done and a cataract done. So it's a bit like looking through a kaleidoscope is a bit too strong of a word, but it's like I see auras. So imagine like looking at, if you remember those old 3D comic books where there'd be like the blue and the red and they'd be sort of off print from each other.
Yeah.
Like when I put 3D glasses on, they don't work for me because I just basically see through either the red or the green
Right.
side. So it's just kind of canceling the other one out. But for me, there's that effect of seeing an image, and then it's like this a secondary image kind of offset to the side is how I see the world. Everything's got this refraction of light, a lighter hue sometimes. Sometimes the hue around is very different. So I will start with those colors as the base tone. So I often work in maybe monochromatic or dual chromatic painting. So I'll start with, I'll try to match that color hue, the aura, as the first tone, and then I'll work from that. That's very common in my paintings. There's some days where sorry, I'm looking off because I've actually got hundreds of paintings on the walls around me
Oh,
right
yeah.
now. So I'm seeing examples of how it changes. I will really just try to express my vision on the day at that time and try to capture it as honestly as I can on every day, because it's looking back at the work, it really is like a journal. It's like a yearbook, and I can very easily look at each of these portraits on my wall, and I will remember where I was and what I was doing, I mean, other than painting at that time.
Yeah, I've got a. I put one of your paintings behind me now, so I can
Oh
see a little an image of
yeah.
it. If I can
Yeah,
get
that's
that
Rod
up.
Padmas. Rod was an actor in Calgary, Alberta. He worked for a company called Shadow Productions, which did, well, this is how I met Rod Padmas. Shadow Productions was a company that did interactive murder mysteries,
Oh, wow.
oftentimes for corporate events. So we would go and do dinner over dinner. You'd have your 25 people kind of eating their meal. We'd come out as the troupe and do, 15, 20 minutes of the murder mystery. Someone would die, they'd get dessert, someone else would die, they'd solve the mystery, that kind of a party. So a lot of actors and improvisers in Calgary worked for this company, and Rod was one of the narrators. Yeah.
I see. So I wanted to ask, let's see, another question, sort of about representation and artwork.
Sure.
I wear glasses myself, and I can't function outside of my house without them, but my glasses fully bring my, vision up to 20/20, so I've never really felt that it was
Oh.
unmanageable. Now that I've gotten older, I do have, like the sort of invisible bifocals.
Oh, bifocals, yeah, me too.
Like I've got a field of vision that's about 15 centimeters to 20 centimeters where everything's in focus. Outside of
Okay.
that, it's not in focus. Like I could never drive safely with, without my glasses on, but I've never felt like that was really unmanageable. For me, I have a sort of a growing disability, which is I've got hearing loss, and it's I've got what's called Meniere's disease, and it started in about 14 years ago. Right now, I've got about probably I've probably only got 20 to 15 to 20% of hearing in my right ear, and my like I can't hear any bass tones at all. Middle frequencies are, kind of a toss up depending on the day. Maybe I've got swelling or something that depending on the what the barometer is reading. And then my left ear is my good ear, but I've noticed something, some, maybe some questionable feeling in there. So I'm a little bit concerned about that. But I've noticed as I've gotten, more progressed with my disease, like whenever I see somebody portrayed on television that has, or a movie that has, the same kind of problems I have, I found it really to be gripping. Like in The Walking Dead, towards the end of the seasons, there was two characters. One was deaf, and one was like me, who was like partially deaf. And Hawkeye, the Avengers character, and his latest TV show, they showed him struggling with a lot of hearing loss and ear ringing, which I have a lot of. And you've put a lot of effort into like outreach and teaching about what you're. What you've going through, is your condition like common enough where you've met other people that have had your like similar experiences to you, or like have you met other survivors of a similar condition that you've had?
Pretty rare. So retinoblastoma, which is what I had, it's cancer of the retina. And I generally, this is a generalization now, things have changed, but I had bilateral, so in both eyes. It was very common at that time that they would remove the eye completely right away, because the fear is that the cancer is going to go up the optic nerve to the brain. So anyone that I have met who's around my age with bilateral retinoblastoma, they have two artificial eyes.
Wow.
I was kind of, this was 19, I can't remember, 75, 76 or something, and it was my parents who basically arm wrestled my doctor to save some of my eyesight. So
Yeah.
they flew me to Toronto, and this doctor in Toronto, I can't remember if his name was Dart or something, basically blasted my, they had to remove my right eye, but he blasted the three tumors on my left eye with radiation. And scar tissue developed over my retina, but just a very small window remains unscarred, which was a shock to them because they figured the whole retina would scar over. So, all that to say, it's pretty rare to meet someone who had bilateral retinoblastoma who had any vision at all, has any vision at all. I think it's more common now that eyesight is being saved. They've also isolated the gene, so they can test the wonders of science, but they can actually test in utero now to find out if the child will be born with retinoblastoma, and they can
Oh.
watch for it very early on. So it is, it's one of those very uncommon cancers that can be tested for and can also be seen. Like, the reason why I was diagnosed was my eye doctor looked into my eyes and he saw the tumors on the retina and he recognized
Wow.
what was going on. There's also but this is something I should mention. There's an organization called Know the Glow, and they're advocates for recognizing early symptoms of childhood eye disease. And one of the ways that you can do that is taking a photograph with flash on of your child. And if there'll be a very distinct look to the pupil of the eye, if there is the presence of any irregularities in the retina, you'll see a glow within the pupil. And again, had someone taken my photograph with the flash on, you would have seen that in my eyes as well. So again, this is a form of cancer and whatever you call it, an irregularity within the eye that can be caught now and dealt with at a much early age. I do meet a lot of people with challenges, like vision challenges, and that's really a result of my doing Assassinating Thompson, which is the show where I paint a portrait of the whole audience and I tell the story of my eyesight, and I even give a brief demonstration. I get the audience to close one eye and make a little tunnel and look down through that through their closed fists in order to get an approximation of how I see. And it's a very explicit description of my visual impairment. And I stand on stage and paint, so it's an encouragement, if you will, for people to get out there and practice art, whatever your ability or your perceived disability. I feel that by being very out and about my visual impairment, it gives other people an opportunity to do the same, and hopefully, just get comfortable talking about it. Because I think that's a huge hurdle for a lot of people, is that they kind of live in silence and expect either the world to adapt for them without any stepping up and saying, here's what I need. How can the world possibly anticipate all of your needs? How can people around you anticipate your needs if you're not clear about what they are? But also, I find in through the course of painting or doing shows or having conversations with people, I also learn a lot about how I see. Spent most of my life trying to hide the fact that I'm visually impaired. And when I started using a white cane, when I started to paint, I actually figured out, oh, like I can see that, or I can't see that, or I'm compensating for that, or I imagine that I'm seeing something, which is oftentimes even more dangerous. I imagine that the street is clear when there's a car coming directly
Yeah.
at me.
And now, a word from our sponsors. Are you tired of the long, arduous walk to the local library or post office just to use the public transporter? Perhaps you need your own personal transporter. Budget transporters, the cheapest way for humans to travel their planet. For a small investment of gold-pressed platinum,
travel adventures will always start from home. Just plug it in, set it in the corner of your room, and follow instructions so simple that even a human victim child could do it.
Does that answer your question? I think I may have babbled a bit. Sorry.
Yes. And actually, it sort of segues into you talked about, you know, telling people what you need. It sort of brought me to the first question I have, which is Star Trek related to your first character, Kemmer. In your, like, you make an appearance at the very end of episode one, but it wasn't until episode two that we heard you have your first conversation with Uhura. Let me get out of the way here. I've got your
there he is. There's Hammer
image with the with the handle of the knife sticking right under his
Oh, it's very, very sharp, that knife as well. So I remember the day we shot it, they said be very careful, it's very sharp.
Well, yeah, if you cut off your finger, that's just a prosthetic finger though, right?
Yeah, at that point I was more prosthetic than human.
But the thing that struck me when I went back and watched the first, when I was rewatching the episodes, sort of doing my homework in preparation, your first word is no. Your first word of the series is no. Like, and you explained to her, you very emphatically established like your ability parameters and like the boundaries that you had. And I found that what you had just described, like if I, in dealing with my own disability, if I'm not, you know, if I want to successfully navigate, you know, my life with coworkers, friends, and even family, like I have to explain a lot what I'm going through, what I'm dealing with. And, I have to tell them, like what I need. So, and otherwise, if I don't, they may have real unrealistic expectations of what I can do, and and they or how I want to be treated. So I thought it was really interesting that, you know, Hammer set this up right away on the first meeting, and it seemed like this was a very real conversation from my perspective, because I recognized it. It definitely wasn't, you know, something that was just thrown out there unnecessarily just to establish character. It was definitely what I considered to be a necessary conversation. Like what advice would you give to people who have maybe have difficulty communicating what they need to other people? Do you have any advice for, you know, especially people who maybe find themselves disabled later in life didn't grow up used to it? Do you have any like advice to give, like how to talk to people?
That is very important. And I think first of all, you got to practice. For me it was years and years of figuring out how to describe the way that I see. I mean, I've got probably 4 shows about it. I've spent 10 years on the road describing how I see. And oddly, the best description of how I see, I didn't come up with. It was someone else describing how I see to a friend. And they said, here's what you do. You put one hand over one eye and you make a little straw with the other hand and look down through that. And that's extreme tunnel vision. Like really narrow your point of view. And imagine like having to do that all the time. And then imagine that you're looking through a murky glass of water. I describe it like a lava lamp. That's the floaters that are constantly moving. So if I shift my eye, the floaters go with it. And so constantly navigating around a screen. You know, it took me a long time to figure that little elevator pitch up. But it gives someone that I'm talking to, if they've got time to even hear it. I mean, sometimes people just don't have the time to hear Here's how I see. Take one and put like they haven't got that amount of time to sit and do it. And sometimes it's a snap judgment. It's a snap decision of you know what? Here's what you need to know. I can't read that. I can't see that. Would you mind reading? And asking those, being comfortable asking those things. It's practice. It takes a long time. I was in some ways, I was a very shy kid, and I would get very reluctant to express what it was that I needed and how I saw the world. But it really is. It's practice. I had a Qigong teacher in my early 20s who had a favorite expression, which was get comfortable being uncomfortable. And oddly, I'm now very, very comfortable expressing how it is that I see the world. I'm not always as comfortable asking for what it is that I need. But again, I think that's a lifelong practice. Sometimes it feels like a lot of energy to ask for what you need, but the flip side of it is that people will not read your mind. Everybody's on their own, on their own journey, and they're not gonna help you out. And most people want to help, so it's an opportunity for to connect with somebody else and give them the opportunity to help you out. And there's a lot of joy in that and wonderful connection.
That was really helpful. I've actually, thought maybe I need to actually make a sound file where people can hear like the kind of noisy, oscillating ear ringing that I have to deal with all day on top of my, hearing loss, so they understand like the kind of
Great.
murky audio situation that I'm going with, 'cause it will interfere with my language processing sometimes. It will it can be really frustrating on days when it's really loud, and it can actually affect my mood by making me irritable. So I think I may just need to go ahead and actually just make an example for someone so that they can understand more what I'm going through.
I think that's a wonderful idea, and I think it reminds me. I saw was in the eye doctor, whatever, years and years ago, and on the wall they had a chart of, and it was the same photograph of a playground, and they had superimposed different, obstacles, and said, well, here's what looking through glaucoma would look like, or here's what looking through RP would look like, and the same image, but sort of blocked, like the center was all grayed out, or the edges were all grayed out, so you. I found that so fascinating. And so when I meet somebody now who says, they've got RP, I can immediately remember that photograph and immediately superimpose where we are at the time and go, okay, this is, maybe not specifically what they're dealing with, but in a generalized form, say, okay, now I understand that. My mother has pretty extreme hearing loss as well. And when she's able to describe it, we go into an environment, she says, oh, it's like everything is louder. It's not just that the hearing aid turns up one element or another. Hearing her description of it is so much more valuable than my own imagination, because somebody's lived experience. So if you have the technical knowledge and wizardry to create a sound file that someone can hear an approximation of how you hear, I think that would be extraordinarily useful.
Yeah, I wanted to ask next about Strange New Worlds. After Hemmer, you came back, and during season two, I was avoiding all spoilers, and I was extremely surprised when the musical started in episode 9. I didn't know it was coming. I had heard maybe there were some rumors about them, touching on something. And when I was watching it, I had no idea that you were in it as well, because you did not play, you were not Hemmer. You were new character, General, what the name is, General Garza, Garkog,
Garkog,
General
Garkog,
Garkog. Yes, this is a great image here. Like when you first show up, I really loved it. Like I guess the eye patch should have been a hint, but having watched all of DS9, we have Martok who has lost an eye in battle. So I just thought eye patch, great costume for a great accessory, for a Klingon. I didn't realize that this was should have been a hint that this was you. Like I didn't recognize your voice. So How soon did you know that there was going to be a musical episode? Was this something that was discussed during the first season, or?
Oh, I didn't know that it was going to be a musical episode, I think, until maybe a couple of months before they shot it. They had to do a fair amount of rehearsal, musical rehearsal,
right,
beforehand. I mean, usually you get the script for the episode like 2 weeks before you shoot it, if that. But this one we knew a fair amount in advance, and that I was going to be a singing Klingon. They had sent two versions of that song, because there was some debate as to whether it was going to be the K-pop version or the Klingon opera. So I got recordings of the two different versions and met with a voice coach, and then had a day where I went into a studio in Toronto and recorded both versions of the song. And yeah, that was a really fun day. Bill Wolkoff, who's one of the writers on the episode, I believe it was Bill, and the producer were in the studio, and we ripped through both versions of it. You know, the obviously took two very different takes on the song, so I got to play within two different ranges, which was super fun. Right. I mean, I love singing that high pop stuff because it's so kind of out of my my normal speaking range. People often hear that and don't think it's me singing, but no, that's me.
That was my next question. Yeah, was that your actual voice range?
Yeah, I mean, it's got some effects processors on it to make it sound, and they certainly, you know, they touched it up a bit, but it's got a real, yeah, that's me singing on that one. And I believe they've actually released the Klingon opera version online now, so you can hear the other version as well.
Wow,
getting to do the K-pop was a total riot.
Yeah, this was in an episode that was full of just I could only describe it as hyper stimulation. I mean, it was so great. Like, I felt like I was like like I felt like I inhaled, but I just didn't exhale until the very end. And I made the mistake of watching this late at night after the family was in bed, and I couldn't sleep for hours after this. I was like, I want to write music right now. I was so excited to. It made me just filled me with inspiration that I had nowhere to aim at the moment, because it was like late at night, and I was like, I gotta suppress this until in the morning. Okay. But yeah. it was an amazing experience.
Marvelous.
I wanted to ask, like, was it different emotionally for you to become General? I want to say his name correctly, General Garkog.
Yes,
because I'm aware that it takes several hours to get into the makeup of Hemmer, and presumably it takes several hours. Was it emotionally different for you to sit in the chair and become someone else that wasn't Hemmer? Because I know as fans, we all got attached to Hemmer, and how was it for you to become a second character as opposed
to... The emotions of it were really attached to getting to be back in the show again.
Okay.
Getting to be back on that set, getting to, yeah, to sit in that prosthetics chair again. I mean, when we finished shooting season one, I thought that was it, you know, and I was, my journey to the stars was over, and then getting to come back for the one episode in season two and then another episode in season two, I really just I was lapping it up. I mean, you gotta understand, like, I never imagined that I would have a career in film and television, let alone on something like Star Trek. Like, they're so beyond anything that I thought was possible. So every moment that I spent on that set in that chair, I just absolutely relished it. And to get to come back and be a Klingon, which is just, you know, they're just such an outrageous species.
Yeah.
Is that the right word for a Klingon species?
I think so.
They're so outrageous. And, you know, getting into that costume and wearing like the armor, like, I think it was after the first take that we did, where I you know, said, "There's a General Garkog of the Imperial Klingon," whatever it was, that his opening scene. I remember the director was on it, but just coming over and going, "Yeah, maybe a little less of the Klingon," because I wanted to play him, like, you know, going with like Christopher Plummer, kind of that extreme of Klingon, you know. But he's a little bit more subdued than that. I can't quite choose. I mean, he chooses the scenery in the song, but not in the scene. It's fun. I really love doing the prosthetic work. I love seeing how they evolve, like how the how those prosthetic technicians, and they really are like artists, create these characters, and I get the chance to embody the voice and the physicality and disappear into that character. I mean, my own brother saw that episode and had no idea that it was me. I mean, my family was laughing at the scene, and then they had to go back and go, "Oh my God, that was Bruce." And like, it made him so joyful. So if you can, or at least for me anyway, as an actor, if I can fool my own family, I feel really, really lucky. Like I got away with something, you know, like in that true Warhol sense of art is whatever you can get away with. I feel like I'm getting away with it if my own brother doesn't know it's me.
Yeah, that's amazing. I really love that. I love that a lot.
It was so fun.
Now the only like I always wonder when I see a lot of prosthetics, I know it takes time and I know it takes patience, but how does it smell and taste? Because that's the one thing that I worry about. Like if I were ever to do that, because I have breathing issues.
It's certainly not for everyone. I found the process of getting into the prosthetics actually quite relaxing. I found it quite therapeutic. Like, first of all, we were coming out of, it was 2021 when we were shooting this thing, so it had already been whatever a good chunk of time where we were in lockdown and quarantines and all that stuff. And so physical, like human contact, was just like, oh my God, I was craving that, hanging out and talking music, and it felt like we were normal while we'd go into that prosthetics trailer, even though Shane and Chris were wearing masks and having to do that. Like, we were hanging out again, and that felt so, it was necessary. But yeah, the smell and the taste, I mean, just to address that a little bit, it's chemically for sure. But they do everything to take as much of that chemical stuff away. And I actually kind of like the smell of certainly the airbrush paints that they use. I kind of like that smell. But again, like, I'm a painter, right? So I dig the smell of paint. So
Being a
to me,
painter probably
that's my
helps a
chocolate
lot.
sauce. It's my chocolate sauce. Yeah, I love it. I love it. Yeah.
The last
Probably gonna be my death, but yeah, no, it's lovely stuff.
I
Turpentine.
think enough paint will make you immune to it. That's what I
Well, that's it, right? Well, didn't they
think.
say Van Gogh like used to lick his brushes? And anyway,
That turned out
maybe.
fine.
Yeah, he's fine.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about was I only just recently found out about very short treks, and you had a that was you were in.
Hammer,
There's only
yeah.
five episodes, and already I need there to be 500. It was so bizarre,
So
hilarious, and
bizarre.
irreverent, and I'm not sure that it's canon, but I really loved it. So like I had. Were all the voice actors in the same place for this, or was this
No.
something that you could do remotely?
No, probably could have done it remotely, but no, I was brought into, can't remember the name of the studio in Toronto. And I did one day, and I showed up to do one episode, and I think they put me in the second one when I showed up. And it was, I'm trying to remember the gentleman's name who created it. He did Too Many Cooks, and oh gosh, I'm blanking on his name. Created and written by, anyway, it's in the credits. But and I'm a huge fan of Adult Swim, and specifically Too Many Cooks, which is an old meme. If you want to Google that, I mean, it'll drive you insane. It's 15 minutes of the same tune, but anyway, it's very funny. So I totally fanboyed at the moment when the screen showed up and I was being directed to do these Hammer roles. I was by myself, and it was literally like, you read in your line, do it four or five different ways. He throws some direction at you. Give it to me like this, try it like this, draw this bit out, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, it was awesome. I have always wanted to do animation and voice work. It's just something that I find so intriguing. And I've often been told that I have a face for radio, so I figure I should maybe try to pursue that at some point. So getting into a sound studio and getting to do this stuff, it was so fun. Didn't see any of the animation until it was all put together, And yeah, what a riot. What a riot
Yeah,
just playing in the sound studio.
I really I've already watched them multiple times, and that the song, the Duty Roster song is
Yeah.
really one of those that can really
Totally.
stick in your head all day long. It really is.
Totally. Totally.
Yeah. Well, that you've basically answered like all my questions that I had prepared for you. Thank you so
Excellent.
much.
My pleasure.
I hope that I'm sure all of us will love to see you in Star Trek again. In my headcanon, there are hours and hours of training footage that Hammer has prepared, and also
Oh, training footage, sure. Yeah.
in my headcanon, there's also an adventure where General Garkog ventures to Earth and he discovers the most honorable instrument available on Earth, which is the banjo, and he starts the first Klingon banjo jamboree back on Kronos.
How did you know I play the banjo?
I saw it. I saw a brief clip on YouTube that you had, and I loved it.
Marvelous.
I grew up a lot in southern Missouri,
Ah.
near Branson, poor person's Nashville,
Yeah,
and
right.
so
Branson,
I
Missouri.
actually my instrument is a violin, more fiddle than violin, and I actually once I took a fiddle lesson from a person named Banjo Billy, who obviously was a banjo player, and you would expect.
Well,
And
the
so yeah,
similarities with the banjo and the violin and the fiddle, I mean, it's yeah, it's all the
are they
same
are the
family.
strings are the strings similar? Are they in fifths or?
No, but I've heard a lot of banjo players that pick out fiddle tunes,
I
and
see.
Norm Pilkenny actually Noam Pilkenny did an album where he covered fiddle tunes,
I see. Yeah,
and
if I wasn't
yeah.
scared of fretted instruments, I would definitely first attack a banjo. Definitely.
Great, great.
Because
Well, and you can get a fretless banjo as well, so get into
I think now that
that.
I've got a number of years with a fretless instrument, and I realize I probably need frets, because just fighting for that pinpoint accuracy, it takes a lot of practice, and I feel like frets sort of do a little bit of work for you as far as
They sure
positions.
do. They sure
Like,
do. Yeah. They're for the lazy. That's what I always say.
I definitely need that then.
What? No
Are
one
there
says that.
I from your website, I noticed you're still doing portrait
I
painting.
sure am. Yeah, I'm doing another one. I'm doing another sitting today. Folks can go to brucehorak.com and they can book a portrait sitting. I do 30 minutes or 45 minutes, different, three different options as to what the project is. I'm working my way towards 1,000 portraits, probably more than that. And yeah, it's a quick and easy and super fun. It also makes a great gift. I've had people buying portrait sittings for their loved ones, and I do it over Zoom. It's super easy and cozy. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it looks like you're still touring with Goblin
Oh.
Theater. Is that
Goblins,
correct?
yes, goblins. We have a show that Goblin Macbeth, and we just finished a run of Goblin Oedipus, which was the follow-up to Goblin Macbeth. But Goblin Macbeth will be on tour, coming to a theater near you. Check your local listings. Nothing that we can officially announce yet, I think, for 2024, but 2025, we're starting at the Citadel Theater in Edmonton.
I
Believe
see.
we're doing a 5-week run in January, February 2025 with Goblin Macbeth. And yeah, that's it. The basic premise is that goblins discover live theater and try to figure it out. That's it in a nutshell. It's got a combination of improvisation and clown, but we also Goblin Macbeth, for instance. I've been told that the review is that it is the best adaptation of Macbeth you will ever see, and probably the last one you need to see.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Are you touring in the US as well as Canada, or is it right now, is it
What we like to
Canada?
say is we are open.
I see.
We're open for business, and that is done through
I see.
spontaneoustheater.ca. Spontaneous Theater has several shows on the docket, but that is the current one that's up and running.
I see. Well, that will pretty much wrap up all my questions. Thank you so much for your
Thank
time.
you. Thanks for having
And
me. Yeah.
I look forward to seeing hopefully a lot more of you in the future.
Right on. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Okay. Thank you for watching. I hope this was entertaining and informative. I want to thank the amazing Bruce Horak for his time and kindness. Please see his website, brucehorak.com, where you can book a portrait session with him and have your likeness made by him or himself. You can also support him directly on Patreon at patreon.com/brucehorak. More information on Goblin Theater can be found at spontaneoustheater.ca. That's theater spelled theatre.ca. When we discussed eye cancer in children, Bruce also mentioned an organization called Know the Glow. You can find more information about that at knowtheglow.org. I want to thank my brother Randall Lippard for the music in the intro and the outro. I'd like to also thank my partners at Meat Lake Production for all the post-production assistance. You can find more about our VFX capabilities and all of our work at meatlake.com. Please like and subscribe to our YouTube channel and let us know if you'd like... Guys, why is the security feed being pumped into the podcast? I told you, you cannot go in there. It's motion triggered. I'm gonna have to record all of this over again, man. I don't care. Why is this difficult? Every time I tell you that I can't... Wait.